Good afternoon. Welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, March 3rd, 2008. I'm Harley Schlanger, and I will be your host. The economic news of recent weeks continues to confirm the authority of Lyndon LaRouche's forecasts. Whether you look at the rapid increase in the number of foreclosures, and it looks as though we are going to hit 2 million or more this year, and the collapse of home prices, or the new record in gasoline prices set daily, or the hyperinflationary increases in food prices and the threat of famine as a result, it is clear that the financial system has broken down. Clear, that is, unless you're George Bush, for whom not much is clear these days, except that he's going to be out of work soon. But it's this systemic breakdown which has had one positive effect, which is that it has discredited the blather of economists of the British Empire school, the hoaxers who push the free trade model. However, even though they've been thoroughly discredited by events in the real economy, their drive for global imperial power has not stopped. This week's issue of the City of London magazine, The Economist, gives us another example of this drive, as it denounces the efforts of governments to assure adequate food for hungry populations. It attacks that as seeking mindless self-sufficiency. In editorializing openly for free trade, even if it means hundreds of millions of people, especially children, will die of starvation, The Economist has joined the Financial Times, also of London, as a promoter of Malthusian genocide to bolster the power of the British Empire. On today's program, we will rip apart the fraud of the so-called economic theory of free trade, exposing it as nothing but a justification of the murderous expansion of the dreams of global domination of the City of London financiers. We'll be joined on the program today by John Hofel, who has written extensively in the EIR on this topic, and who has just written an effectively provocative polemic against these killers, which will appear in the May 2nd issue of the Executive Intelligence Review. We also have members of the LaRouche Youth Movement to discuss this today. We have Michael Kirsch and Frank Mathis from Boston. And they'll be discussing the topics that John will be talking about and also the mobilization to defeat once and for all the dangerous sophistry of British imperial power. So, John, welcome to the program.
Oh, my pleasure, Harley.
Let's begin with a summary of your article, "The United States is at War with the British Empire." You make the ironical point within it that this is not really economics as most people know economics, and the topic is a war. So what's the basic area you're covering here?
Well, the point is that in order to understand all of the various things that are going on, you have to rise above the particulars and see the whole. And the whole is that whether individual Americans consider themselves at war with the British Empire or not, that the British Empire has declared war on the United States. And this is a war for survival. Their survival versus ours. That this whole question of globalization, of pushing free trade, of the collapse of the financial system, this is all a culmination of a long-term strategy by the British Empire to end the nation state and return to the days of the empire, because they see themselves threatened by the success of nation states. That, you know, if you have nation, in a world in which you have nation states which are successful, the empire has a lot less room to negotiate. They have a lot fewer people they can loot. So the success of the nation-state system is to the detriment of the empire, and vice versa. So there's always been this war between the two. And if
John, what you would say then is that we've actually, because of the systemic breakdown of the system, that we're now at a point where we're at the end of an era one way or the other.
Yes. Yes, the systemic breakdown, in fact, was built into the system. That the way in what this bubble that we just went through, which is now collapsed, and this financial system that has collapsed, was designed to fail for the purposes, it was a way of inducing the United States to commit economic suicide. We were set up to go along. We went along with this because we were set up by the British Empire, who tend to look at things over a much longer time frame than we do. So all of these things that have happened, the collapse of the banking system, you know, this is all being used right now as a way of pushing the United States under and pushing other nation states under so that the empire can survive.
John, I want to come back to some of the specific points you make, but I want to pick up on something you just said. We were induced to go along with this. What is it that causes people who are in positions of government, of responsibility, whether it's the Federal Reserve, the banking system, what is it that allowed them to sit there and go along step by step with the dismantling of what had been the most successful economic model in history, that of the American system, from Hamilton to Lincoln to Franklin Roosevelt? Why did they go along with this British attack and essentially commit suicide?
Well, it starts with the fact that because our educational system has been corrupted, people aren't taught real economics. So people don't understand Hamilton economics, Hamiltonian economics. We've been taught that our system is based upon Adam Smith and free trade, and we bought into that. But the other thing that really sells it is the greed, the idea that we can make you a lot of money. If you're in the elite, we can make you a lot of money. That the way in which this bubble was sold, this switchover into the so-called information age and the service economy, was basically the replacement of industry with finance, was funded by, the switch was funded by the creation of a spot market in oil and the enormous pile of petrodollars which piled up in the city of London and other places in Europe, which was then fed back into the United States as financial warfare to build this bubble. And as people started making money off of it, they started more and more go along with the plan. You know, everybody knows that you can rationalize just about anything if you think there's something in it for you.
Well, John, you remember when the two of us were back in Texas in the early 80s with the banking deregulation, and the Texas bankers were told, the savings and loan people were told, go along with getting rid of the regulations because that will lead to a flow of money into Texas. And once they bought into it, the flow of money went in the other direction. It went out of Texas. But those same people still went along with this system into the more extreme forms of deregulation under Greenspan starting in 1987.
Yeah, because, you know, the way this thing is presented is that this is progress, that this is the natural development of an economy, and that globalization is here to stay. You can't buck it. You can't go back. That the problems we had, you know, you can remember Enron and the screaming that Enron was doing. The problem is we haven't deregulated fully. The reason
you
why
the
California
same thing now about banking, right?
The reason why California had electricity shortages and blackout was because they didn't deregulate enough. Now we're told that the reason why our financial markets aren't working is because we haven't deregulated enough, that there are too many rules. The rules are oppressive. The capital rules, that all of these other restrictions are all too oppressive, and if you just free us, we'll solve this problem, which, of course, is absolute nonsense, because the more you relax the rules, the worse things get.
Well, John, what I do want to bring in our panel in a couple of minutes, but I want to get to two questions you pose in the article. One is that that what we're seeing here is a commitment, as you said earlier, to imposing a new system, a global fascist system. I want to talk about that. And then I also want to pick up this question of cui bono, who benefits, that there really are people who think this is the best system, even though they know the consequences, that this will bring fascism. So you make the argument, as Lyndon LaRouche has for years, that doing away with the Franklin Roosevelt regulated American system, the only other option is fascism. Why is that the case?
Because when you destroy an economy, you destroy the productive capacity of the economy, then that economy can only exist by stealing. And you have to start, the powerful will steal from the poor. You know, that's the way it works. They've got the power. And you have to, and that, this is a fascist system. And you have to have a fascist political system in order to pull this off. You have to have a system which defends the right of the powerful to loot from the poor. That the poor are treated as basically as cattle to be harvested as needed. And that you protect the rich because the rich is what the country really is. You know, and we have seen in this the growth of the cartelization. This is the same thing as Mussolini corporatism, and this was the same thing that produced Hitler. The creation of these giant global cartels, which are more interested in controlling the world than they are in benefiting mankind.
Well, we're also seeing the attack on the constitutional nature of our republic and the establishment of private security, private armies. You make the point, for example, in London, that on every street corner there are now cameras and videos, and our activity on computers are monitored. Don't you think most people have some sense that they've lost some of this freedom? The so-called free trade has made them less free?
I think they do. You know, the argument that if you've got nothing to hide, you don't have to worry about anything, it really wears thin. And the point that I would make on all of this is that they don't put these powers in place just to do it. They're not, the target is not, they say it's to keep an eye on terrorists, but that's not what it is. The target is the American population, or in the case of Britain, the subjects of the Queen. But they put these things in place because they have plans to use them. They think they will need them. And if you think about what kind of a world would it be when they need these things, it gives you a picture of where we're going if we don't turn this thing around.
You're listening to John Hofel from the Executive Intelligence Review. This is the LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, May 3rd, 2008. And we're talking about putting an end to the British Empire, which, if we don't do it, will probably put an end to us. Now, John, the other question I wanted you to get at is, someone who looks at this article who's a typical American know-nothing will say, well, he's saying there's a conspiracy here. And, you know, you have certain numbers of people in this country who look for conspiracies everywhere, who try to connect the dots and, you know, basically think that if their life isn't going well, it's because there's a conspiracy against them. But then you actually have the fact that there is a plan for a global empire. So you raise the question in the article, who benefits? And that's an important question that has to be asked in order to develop a counter-strategy. So who is benefiting by this policy, which, as is now acknowledged, has led to a situation where there are food riots in countries, people are starving to death, the physical economy is collapsing, disease rates are increasing, we face new plagues and total social breakdown. Who benefits from this?
Well, the people who think they're benefiting from this are the financial oligarchy, the people centered around the British Empire and the Anglo-Dutch liberal system, because they believe that by collapsing the nation state, by dramatically reducing the population of the world, that they will then have complete control over raw materials and technologies and food supplies and all these sorts of things and trade in these things, and that they can control the world, and that they can then be on top of the much reduced world. And, you know, they see the growth of populations around the world as a direct threat because, you know, as nations develop, then the political structure of the world changes. And the power structure that these people had before, you know, back in the days of the empire, goes away. They want to go back to that. They think that that's, you know, it's their right to rule the earth. And they still believe this. This is not a fantasy. This is what they do. They believe it.
And when you put it that way, it seems so irrational, but obviously they've been able to sell it, and we'll get into this in just a moment, how they sell it. And one of the things they did to sell it is to create the environmentalist movement to induce the Americans to become anti-science and anti-technology. But before I get into that, I want to give an announcement for our listeners that this coming Wednesday, May 7th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Lyndon LaRouche will be holding another webcast. And as this crisis has deepened and escalated, and also as there's become an opportunity to use the crisis to end the rule of this oligarchy, at each step along the way, Lyndon LaRouche has provided detailed analysis and also the method by which he makes the analysis, so that it's accessible to any American who has a phone or has a computer, access to a computer. So at this coming Wednesday, May 7th, on LaRouchePack.com, that's LaRouchePac.com, you can hear the live webcast from Washington, D.C. with Lyndon LaRouche. If for some reason you can't get it live, it will be up shortly afterwards. It will be archived and available for people to listen to and to spread around. Now, also a new pamphlet by Mr. LaRouche on the issues of the 2008 election. His report, an interim report from LaRouche PAC to the American people on what you're looking at, is available. And so I would like to encourage people to call in, to get in contact with people in the LaRouche movement. You can contact us through the website, LaRouchePack.com, and order copies of the pamphlet. It probably will be posted on the website as well. Now, I'd like to bring in on this question of how it is they sell this, our youth panel, because, you know, for our generation, John, the 68er generation, as a result of developments in the 1960s, the wave of assassinations, emergence of Nixon, the Vietnam War, the murder in 1968, 40 years ago, of Dr. Martin Luther King and then Bobby Kennedy, had a profound impact, I know, on me. It made me more open to new ideas politically, but many in our generation started smoking pot, protesting everything and hugging trees. Now, that became the culture. The counterculture of the 60s became the dominant culture. And one of our LIM panelists is someone who, when I first met, seemed to be a modern-day version of the tree hugger. In fact, he looked like a tree. And now here he is engaging in the most advanced scientific work in building the alternative to this collapsed system. So, Michael Kirsch, I'd like you to reflect a little bit on how what you've learned from studying economics and studying science, which is applicable to the fight to end the British Empire.
Well, first of all, I didn't know that I looked like I had bark on my skin. Not sure about that.
It looked like you were covered in moss, but that's another story.
We'll spare our listeners the details. Well, I think we're discussing this problem of society right now, that it's going in a direction where the principles upon which the existence of the nation state depends are being not utilized or being destroyed, intentionally destroyed. And I think one of the things that the leaders out there, the people who are the movers and shakers of society, have to understand is that it's these deeper, long-term societal characteristics which really is what you have to trigger if you're going to mobilize people to overthrow this current regime of free trade and other mechanisms that are being used right now by the British Empire and have been used repeatedly to destroy ourselves. That these deeper memories of our country have to be tapped, because you know it's not that you have one event triggers another event. This thing happens, and maybe we'll be able to mobilize the population if we can get them excited about this one thing that happens that's affecting them right now. But the fact is that people are driven and are excited and inspired by the fact that they exist in a domain of long-term human ideas, long-term discoveries. And if you look at it in any field of research, you're always looking at something which is the result of many minds, successive minds that produce what you're looking at. And in terms of economics and free trade and what we're dealing with, we've got a history of this country where we're against free trade. We're opposed to it. The way that our country was put together was opposed to it. Hamilton and Franklin, these people. We actually were created in not only against fighting against the tea, right, and the taxes, things like this coming from a empire, but we were intentionally created to create something that would root that type of usurious system out from the rest of the world. And the problem is you have in all types of political discussions, it's this question that John's cleared the crap out of the way. We can get into some of these deeper things. That's one of the role he plays, right? But what he started this discussion out with is what is the discussion? It's the nation state versus the British Empire. Well, you don't hear that when you sit down with someone on Capitol Hill.
Well, Michael,
you don't
let
hear
me
that
ask you
when you're. What's that?
Well, let me ask you, because you, before you came into the basement, you were organizing. You organized in Seattle and in Boston. And you know, coming from where you came from, that this question of posing, well, first of all, that you can't go to school and learn this right now. You can't learn about the British system versus the American system. That everything points you in the direction of environmentalism and post-industrial society. How do you discover this?
Well, it's rooted in the fact that the way that citizens in a nation, the way that people in an environment associate with that is that they're affected by their situation, but they also determine it, and they determine it in a special way that's beyond just the way that an animal determines their environment, which they take in the food, they excrete things, they have long term effects on their environment. But what we can do, and this is what I think what you're asking, and what the root of this thing is, the difference between human beings in an economy, what an economy is, the fact that what we can do is we can make intentional decisions to define our environment. We're not based on reacting to things that occur based on a previous set of condition of the economy. We can take an active choice to say, here's a policy of government, here's a policy for the people of the country, and we're going to implement this technology, this policy, this regulation. And we can compose the way that we implement these things to achieve some type of long-term effect. But these things don't have to happen to us, and we are sitting here saying all of these things are happening, and here's our line on how we're going to react to it. But that we can make a decision to compose in a way which one decision may lead to a bigger opportunity later on, but with an effect of achieving a process of development of the whole people in a nation. And that's the thing that isn't being carried out right now. People are saying we have to deal with this limitation, we have to deal with the fact that we've got this crisis, this budget crisis, and they're not thinking outside because they're not thinking about the full potential of what mankind can really do.
Well, if you talk to a 68er or an example of a 68er like Fat Al Gore, what you just described is the natural process of human societal development. They would describe as arrogance, the idea that man has power over nature. And I'd like to bring in our other LIM panelist now, Frank Mathis, up in Boston. Frank, you've certainly seen this in the organizing you do, where the environmental view is anti-human. So how do you deal with that when you confront it in at such centers of learning as Harvard or Massachusetts Institute of Technology?
Well, a lot of this stuff really has to be dealt with from the standpoint that Mr. LaRouche has just been recently discussing it, from the standpoint we're discussing this thing right now, is that you have two systems. One of them goes towards the development and care of human beings. One of them goes towards the destruction, the slashing, the burning, the total annihilation of anything that represents humanity. Now, I mean, it reflects itself in different ways in a place like Boston because of its history, because of the institutions. You have Harvard University. You have the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which is a haven for the environmental slash computer-driven artificial intelligence crap that's come out of this place, and other institutions. But on the streets, it's playing itself out in a funny way because the collapse has hit. The collapse has hit. It's not hitting. It's not going to hit. And the types of responses that we've been getting on the streets are they're a lot different than they previously were. I mean, first off, you can take the mortgage foreclosure crisis, which last year we had some trouble fighting with people on, but people would be able to get it. We mobilized around the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act. We have 80 to 90 cities signed on. We have 3 states signed on. That was a fight in and of itself. But now that you have a food crisis, you have an explicit in people's face food crisis. You have the hampering down on rice products, on grain. You go to the street nowadays, and you mention feeding Haiti. You get 5 people at the table immediately. So
you're
the environmentalists.
You're seeing a shift against the biofuels and these other kinds of crazy ideas as a result of the food crisis. Then
there's a total shift. Especially, I mean, at least in this area, we also are able to deploy into Rhode Island and some other places. But it's a very obvious shift. And, I mean, people are up in arms because they have no idea what to do about it. First off, they didn't expect it. So our unique role on the streets and in the different institutions on a daily basis is to give to people, to communicate people the discoveries that Lyndon LaRouche has made. Because when you say to someone that LaRouche discussed this in this manner explicitly in the 80s and the 70s, these guys totally respond. And that's a lot of the responses that we've been getting. It's not just that we have a solution to the crisis, but that we already knew how to solve the crisis before it had to occur. LaRouche already knew this. He discussed it with Russia. He discussed it with South America. He discussed it with the Middle East. And the response against the greeny Malthusian bullcrap, to be explicit, has been very, very good.
Well, John, part of your function, your essential unique function, is to make a mockery of these kinds of crazy ideas, which unfortunately are, until recently, have been the center of public opinion. I'd like you to take up one of them right now, which is the hardcore British free trade line that food is essentially a question of supply and demand, and that the market will take care of food needs, and you don't need government intervention to ensure there's enough food for the hundreds of millions and billions of people in the world who face starvation precisely because of these free trade policies. So how do you answer that?
Well, I'd say that if you view food as a, from its profit potential, instead of as something which is necessary for the existence and development of mankind, then you're a parasite. Because food supplies should not be used for political gain. They should not be used, you know, the idea that you're going to charge as much as you can get away with, and that that's the free market, and that's, as they love to call it, price discovery, that you find the proper price for the food by seeing how much you can charge for it. Well, this is insane. And it's immoral. And if you have right now, you have enormous speculation in food because the securities machine died. Money is pouring in to speculation in food because people still have to eat. They may not.
When you say the securities, when you say the securities machine died, you mean the ability to make money in these funny financial instruments is causing them to look elsewhere for profit.
Yes. Yes. And so now they've decided that they're going to speculate on food because people still have to eat. You may not need mortgage-backed securities and CDOs, but you do need food. So they're going into food to make up for the profits that they're no longer making, or actually to cover the holes that have been blown in their balance sheets. And they're running the price of food up beyond the ability of many people to pay for it. And that's criminal.
How much of this price run-up is due to this kind of speculation in futures markets, and how much of it is related just to something more simple like the collapse of the dollar?
Well, it's both. It's both. But the collapse of the dollar is related to all of the money that the Federal Reserve and the governments and the depth of this financial system and the way in which money is being flooded in to try to subsidize. So the attempt to save the system by flooding it with money kills the dollar. The attempt to save the system by speculating on food and gasoline is killing the population.
And Michael, I believe you were part of the team that put together the original video Firewall, which described how this process unfolded in 1923 with the Weimar hyperinflation. Are you seeing we're getting tremendous response to people who are seeing that video, but you see how absolutely accurate it is to make that comparison.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's the same sick method of destroying a country. It's basically what you're talking about is you have something which is set up by Ben Franklin and Hamilton as a function to best allocate the resources that the mind of man, the creative capacity of man develops as a product of its interaction with its environment. And Franklin actually, in his paper on money, was the first, he made the argument for why barter is just so damn inefficient if we want to develop human beings. You take the ability to now, what I'm referring to as the Hamiltonian banking system, credit system, where you're taking taxes, you're creating a medium from which to direct the money system is the medium that you set up. It's not just money, but it's a medium in which to have the interactions of the parts of your economy. And the banking system interacts with that in terms of being able to allocate resources so that you are able to fund projects that will be paid off in a long term. In the long term, you have that organized. Now, you're taking that process, which is set up to develop the nation state, and you're turning it on the people. You're finding a way to take the effects of that and then basically loot a whole population and destroy a whole population. And that's what you had in 1923 with the hyperinflationary blowout, is you take this financial system and you create a situation where they have to print money and at wild rates in order even to try to keep their population alive because of the extreme conditions that were created by the British at the Versailles Treaty. But the monetary system, as you see, had nothing to do with what happened. It was simply an effect of the process, and that's what's going on now. That's why you can't what Barney Frank and others in Congress want to do in terms of trying to manage this thing and throw more money at it, somehow bail it out, is a result of not discussing reality. Not discussing the reality is how this thing came about, which was simply a intention to destroy us. And that's what happened in 1923. It was a tension you can see from before the war, before the war to destroy Germany. And all you saw in the aftermath of Versailles was simply the proof of what the British had intended all along.
And then our next effort is on this 1932 video, which will demonstrate, again, this British effort to impose fascism using the breakdown of Germany after World War I and the fascist movement of Mussolini, as John has been talking about it, as an example. For those of our listeners who have not seen it yet, the video Firewall is available on the LaRouche PAC website. And if you view it and you want your friends to see it, you can order copies of the DVD, or you can just direct them to the website. But this is part of this process of educating Americans. Now, Frank, I wanted to ask you, coming back to the question of biofuels and the reaction, is the luster off Fat Al Gore a little bit now, or are people beginning to realize that this was nothing but a public relations hoax, giving him an Academy Award and a Nobel Prize?
Yeah, people realize that, and that's good. But one of the major problems still is you have people who have a reaction against biofuels. They have a reaction against Al Gore. They have a reaction against the Congress for passing this bill, this Energy Act. But they don't have a deeper sense, as Michael was bringing up earlier, they don't have a deeper sense of a relationship to a social memory, that there's a social memory in our country, and that these types of attacks have always been run by the British Empire. They have no sense of it at all. And our main fight on the streets has been to really attempt to get this thing across. Now, Mr. LaRouche has been discussing lately this project, the 1932 project, from the standpoint of getting a sweep of history. You have 1932, which a lot of people see as a good year. They may not know why. They know something about Roosevelt. They've heard the word New Deal or the term New Deal, but there's no deeper sense of an active political fight that was waged against the explicit British Empire. And one thing we've been rather successful with, even though we've only been doing it for a few weeks, is really bringing people deeper into this history project with us. Because we're going to be putting out a video on some of the implications of 1932, the implications of the ouster of Otto von Bismarck, who was the Chancellor of Germany. He got kicked out, and that immediately led to World War I. We're already bringing people into this process. We're getting people to read LaRouche's papers, to read the articles that we're putting out. There's classes that are being given on some of these different parts of the history, some of the parts of the American system. And one of the main things that's been coming up a lot, which has been very good, is the fight around this food crisis has really provoked people to look back into our history and things like the fight over tariffs, over protective tariffs, and why just this idea of a protective tariff for a nation to be able to protect your food supply, to protect your industrial supply against foreign interests, is an extremely important idea. It's an extremely important concept. So the population has been able to respond a lot more better to our organizing because we've heightened our organizing around really drawing the line between, no, look, this is British. Al Gore is a British agent. He's exactly the type, set, name, and address that these guys like to deploy against America, and then walking people through some of the history.
John, I think it's to come back to you again on one of these major points of tariffs, for example, or protectionism. Even people who seem to be now drawing the conclusion that maybe NAFTA and free trade is not all it was cracked up to be, still have this view that if you don't have free trade, you won't have trade. And they seem to have missed the point that the United States was a trading nation even when we had tariffs to protect American industry and agriculture. So how do we get this point across to people that the idea of free trade is not a new idea, but it does go back to the period after 1763 with the consolidation of the British Empire and the East India Company? What do you think is the best way to communicate to people that this line that free trade is modern and it's based on computer society, the same people who argue for financial innovation, that this is just another name for the empire?
Well, I think that's the way you have to put it. You have to make people understand that this empire does exist, that it's real, that it is the single most powerful political force on the planet at this point, but it is extremely weak also. It's got an extreme vulnerability. But that you look at the development of these cartels which control things, you look at things like what happened to California with Enron, you look at the food riots, you look at what's happened to the U.S. manufacturing capacity, that these things were all done through this cartel arrangement, which is the empire, the way the empire works. And that if you have to protect yourself from this, we have this populist view in this country, so many people believe that the government is the problem, that if we get the government out of the way, that all will be well. When in fact the truth is, however flawed our government is, however incompetent so much of it is at this point, however corrupt it is still the only thing that stands between us and unbridled looting by this empire. You've got to understand that the empire exists, and you have to understand what it's trying to do, and you have to understand that it is coming after you, and if you don't have a government to defend yourself against it, it's going to eat you alive.
Well, I think this does get also to the question of the history project, the question of culture. And then, Michael, on a deeper level, the ideas of Vernadsky, which you've been, in a sense, talking about a little bit, but this concept of how the creative powers of man is at the center of an economy. You've been working on this for quite a while with the basement work, and I'd like to bring this back to a question which I get a lot of times from people who marvel at the youth movement, and they say, how do you get so many smart young people, and they're dedicated and committed? And one of the things I tell them is that there's been a curriculum which includes going through the work of Johannes Kepler and now Carl Friedrich Gauss. And people say, well, what does that have to do with the question of understanding economics? So I'd like to throw that out to you, Michael.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think if you go back to the work of a man named, his last name is Tilak. You got his first name, I think.
Well, Tilak is okay for me.
Okay. Well, in his work, The Orion, this is a scholar from India at the end of the 1800s, 1890s, he's writing his work. And what he looked at was with the Rig Veda, which is one of the, which is held as a religious document in India. And he took this from the standpoint that many of the passages demonstrated that the time period in which that had to be written was much earlier than people thought, by thousands of years. And he did this by showing that what was being described in the Rig Veda was in fact settings of the of positions of the moon and where it was and when it was and at the vernal equinox, or how the moon was in relationship to where the what constellations were in the vernal equinox and the winter solstice at what time periods. And what he demonstrates in this work was the crucial point that early man was recording the motions of the heavens, which many archaeologists and people had assumed, did not happen. And in his second work, Arcticum and the Vedas, he shows that mankind had a much deeper, that the origin of the Aryan race had even a time period where they were up in the Arctic before the Bering Strait had opened up. But what this demonstrates, which was crucial, that mankind's early development was a relationship with the whole universe, of looking at the stars, looking at cycles, and finding out which cycles repeated, which didn't. But this concept of change in cycles, change in the world around us, and being able to find order in the change, and then therefore being able to organize society in terms of navigation, agriculture, and things like that, but specifically travel. You have this origin of man is that man has a concept of the universe and of discovery with inside of it. So what you get is that the way that that mankind and society has to develop is around that capability, and that we come together to promote that capability and figure out things, make discoveries of science which are based on that same principle of finding the order in a change. And what you get with the process of the history, which is what our political movement is based on, the scientific history, is a succession of discoveries from the Pythagoreans, who, within this foundation of astronomy, begin to look at how then the measurement, how the concept of measurement goes into degrees of differentiation of principle with the early Pythagorean work. And the development of science then takes you forward to the work of Kusa and Kepler, which are then starting to look at how that has to, how the concept of differentiation of change interacts with the universe, which is based on principles, physical principles, which was the study of Kepler's work with astronomy, with the orbits. Now, the reason why this is, reason why you can't understand how to shape an economy without this lineage of history is that what we're dealing with in economics is, again, human beings that decide to make explicit changes in their environment, even though, you know, as the people who argue Al Gore's point, are we using up our resources? We are using up our resources, and but we are capable of using that crisis, which is a crisis at a certain point, as we have been, there's certain resources that mankind's going to have to figure out how to replenish. We can use that crisis as an opportunity to say, because we're humans, we can decide to intentionally make breakthroughs in dealing with resources. And now the way that this happens is these breakthroughs we make are in the form of scientific discoveries. And the way that they're related is related in a way in which is related in the fact that these principles that we employ are existing in the real universe. And the real universe happens to work in the way that mankind over long periods of time have, in his own mind, rationalized and conceptualized that process to work. So the process of mankind throughout history in discovering these principles of nature in his own mind becomes now a way in which mankind can conceptualize the relations among the discoveries that mankind makes himself. And so we can actually compose our society around the way that the unique characteristics of the whole universe works.
Well, this is what you were describing before, Michael, when you were talking about what Benjamin Franklin did, because Franklin was both an economist and a scientist.
Yeah, and because you have a, if you realize that mankind has this potential to make unique discoveries, which you have to understand inside yourself, then you look around you and you say, you know, why isn't this the natural state of society? Well, there's a reason for that. It's because most people around the world live like slaves. And you don't get discoveries when you're hungry all the time. And the reason that that's the case is obviously because of an intentional economic destruction of the nation state. And there's an ongoing battle, as we've been discussing today. We're in an ongoing war. But you look around you and you say, well, we got to make it like that. And the way we do that is we implement these technological discoveries into society more and more. And as Ben Franklin thought in his great predecessor Leibniz, it's only the human species that has that capability to say, well, we're going to compose ourselves to be in accordance with the unique discoveries that have been made. And the effect of that is to achieve then a higher capability to move forward based on the new things that will be figured out.
Well, that also, when you ask the question, why don't we see this, I think that also has to do with the fact that we have a lot of people in this country who think Hannah Montana is actually a singer. Frank, you've done some work. The Boston Local is the flagship local for the cultural campaign around the work on Bach and choral singing. Is it clear to people who are in this process, what Michael's describing, that you're dealing with the same physical universe when you look at the work of a creative genius like Bach, the same universe that Leibniz and Kepler saw?
Well, our fight is to make it clear. You have, you know, we have newer people. We have people who have been around doing similar things for a while. But our fight, also recently, there's some interesting questions that came up. Our fight is to really make this concept clear, because the type of thing that we're doing with the singing, if people don't know, it's technically called bel canto, Florentine bel canto, as Mr. LaRouche recently reiterated. And one of the main problems, or I guess challenges, it's a very good challenge, the main challenge that we've run into is that there are not textbooks written on bel canto. There are not massive amounts of discussions written on this thing and passed around. The only thing we have in terms of the science of bel canto is actual singing, is the history of the development of the singing voice, the history of the development of choruses, of great symphonies, of piano sonatas, and all these different things which culminate the classical legacy of music, which we're attempting to continue. And one thing we've been recently organizing around up here is really to dig into Bach, to Johann Sebastian Bach, because he was the beginning of a revolution in science. Not simply music, it was obvious to people that he was a musician, but he was the beginning of a revolution in science. He explicitly won out to organize the human mind and to lift it to the angels, as I think he once said himself. We recently had a performance of one of Bach's motets, and we've been working towards developing some of his other pieces, the Lobet dem Herrn, which is another religious motet like the former one, and then also looking at some Mozart and others. But I think for us here in the Boston office, the issue of science is an extremely crucial issue. We've been studying the Kepler also, who's supposedly the predecessor to the development of the concept of a musical system, which actually uplifts an entire society. Beauty, science, music, these different concepts. And we've also been taking it out to the streets, fighting with people on the streets around this idea of economics as a human science, and why the development of the physical sciences, the plastic sciences, the arts, the music is a crucial issue. We've actually gotten a lot of contacts in on just some of those types of discussions.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're listening to The LaRouche Show. We've been engaged in a discussion with John Hofel from the Executive Intelligence Review and LaRouche Youth Movement members Frank Mathis and Michael Kirsch. And what keeps coming up as a central subject, which most Americans are, I would say, dramatically lacking in an understanding of real history. And this has been a topic that's been the subject of a couple of papers recently by Lyndon LaRouche, Project Genesis and the project before us, and then his masterful interim report on the 2008 election, which brings this question back up. So, John, let me throw this out to you. We're seeing an end of an era collapse. We also see a recognition that if there's not a change, we'll have starvation, and with starvation, battles over resources, and these are always in under geopolitical conditions, the imposition of geopolitical forms of confrontation. This always leads to war, and we're seeing, as Lyndon LaRouche warned this last week, a danger of moving into asymmetric warfare with Russia and China in defending themselves, being put into a situation where there may be a new world war. So, John, as a curmudgeon, as someone who's been studying this for many, many years, give the listeners a cause for hope. Is there, coming out of this, a lifting of the fog and a beginning of a grasping of these new ideas, which are really not so new, as we find out, that go back to the Pythagoreans and earlier?
Well, you know, in a sense, the irony is that what is being pushed as modern is actually very old, and what is being derided as old is actually very new. You know, as usual, it's completely backwards. And that as people are waking up to the seriousness of this, they begin to take their responsibilities as citizens more seriously. They begin to think about things in a more serious way. And when everything starts to collapse around you, you either have to figure out what the problem is and move to deal with it, or you go hide in a hole. And there are a lot of people who are standing up now, and that makes them very receptive to what we're saying. We see a lot of action around the country on the HBPA, which is the only thing, that's the beginning of solving this problem, is putting up the firewall, freezing this financial paper and beginning to work this all out. You know, so there's a way to do this. We have a system of government which is designed to do this. We have the policies that have been laid out by Lyndon LaRouche on exactly how to go about it. You know, it's no mystery. It's worked before. It worked for FDR. It worked for Hamilton. These policies work. And they're there, and our government is of the sort that allows us to implement these policies. It's just really a matter of us deciding we're going to do it.
So in spite of the fog that's been pumped in around the presidential campaign, we're seeing this kind of clarity starting to emerge with the collapse this last week of Obama, as Lyndon LaRouche had said he would collapse, and the potential to forge an alliance which would represent the interests of the people who had been supporting Obama, as well as the interests of the people supporting Hillary Clinton, and even the people who support John McCain, because they're all American citizens who are facing this crisis. I believe next week on our program we'll be taking up the political situation, because we have the events coming up this next week which will provide more meat for the topic. On Tuesday, the primaries in Indiana and North Carolina, which seem to be trending toward Hillary Clinton, as the Obama campaign seems to be going through the self-destruction for which it was set up for. And secondly, on Wednesday, I want to remind our listeners again, a webcast Wednesday, May 7th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Lyndon LaRouche addressing this crisis. I don't have it in front of me, but I think the topic is tragedy and hope. Isn't that the topic of the webcast?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a moment of great potential tragedy, but from that tragedy, there's always the hope that these ideas we've been discussing will emerge. So next week, I'm relatively certain we'll have on the LaRouche Show a discussion of how this fight against the British Empire is unfolding, both in the U.S. election process and also in the ideas put forward by Lyndon LaRouche. We have just a little more than 2.5 minutes to go. Frank or Michael, if you have anything else you'd like to add, just jump in.
Well, I would like to make one more comment about some of the music work that we've been doing all around the country in each one of the youth locals, because the challenge has been, and this is more recently recognized, the challenge has been to actually rediscover a method of communication, an entire art, whether it's called bel canto, whatever it's called, to rediscover an entire art and communicate that to the future generations. Because of the fact that society has been so destroyed, because the living standards of people have been smashed down to the ground, as Michael was saying, you have no real continuation, you have no real excitement around the very food which is humanity. Human beings don't live off of food. We need food to survive our physical bodies, but human beings actually develop and propagate throughout the planet based on the effective communication of new ideas, beautiful ideas, new ways to organize society, new ways to educate people. And with the loss of an entire section of science, which is music, which is classical music, you can see why society is tending towards the types of things it's tending. So the challenge that Mr. LaRouche has put into our lap up here in Boston and in all the other locals in America to rediscover bel canto and to be able to communicate it, to make sure that this thing will not be lost since it was developed in the 1400s, 1500s. That's a really fun challenge that we've been dealing with.
And I would simply say people should conceptualize the world situation and come up with particular questions in your own mind, and be prepared to have Lyndon LaRouche on Wednesday challenge those assumptions.
Good, and I think we'll also at some point soon have a program on why middle C, the do, has to be tuned at 256, the so-called Verdi tuning, why this is an essential part of science and culture. So I think this has been a very profound and useful discussion. I'd like to thank John Hofel for joining us, and Michael Kirsch and Frank Mathis. And to just reiterate, this coming Wednesday will be one of the most important presentations ever delivered from Washington, D.C. and in addressing this crisis and the solutions to the crisis. So I'm sure all of you should organize your friends to listen Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern. That's it for the LaRouche Show today. See you next week.